money on drugs, and then he needs to find more money to buy more drugs. That was his situation when one night his sister was headed to the mall and he decided to go with her.
While she's in another store, I'm over in Penny's throwing stuff in a bag and walking right up to the return desk. You know, I didn't even leave out of the store with it. I just brought her out to the return desk, and then they gave me my transaction, which is a gift card, and I started walking out, and when I hit the doors, I got grabbed. And, you know, and police came and ran my record, and then next thing I know, I'm down at the station with a $100,000 bond. For $111. You know, that's because of my record.
So the state locked him up for 2.5 years. It costs about $20,000 a year. So let's say the state spent $50,000 to quote-unquote treat him. That treatment has been elders mostly sitting around in an overcrowded prison dorm. On the plus side, it's true he hasn't shoplifted again. Here's another kind of goofy case, William Jessup.
I was convicted of being in possession of a stolen license plate sticker.
Not a stolen car, not a stolen license plate, just the sticker on the plate. Jessup was sentenced to 4 years for that crime. Now, as is usually the case, there's more to it. There were concurrent cases and he was released from prison even though he was supposed to be held in a county jail on a different charge. It's a bit of a hot mess and I won't waste time going into all of it. Like I said, it's all pretty goofy.
I am embarrassed to admit it's my fourth incarceration. I lost my best friend when I got divorced, and thank God we talk now after 5 years, and I have a beautiful son, very well-behaved boy, and he's very smart, and he has a very outspoken disposition. He lets me know when how stupid I really was, and it breaks my heart knowing that I'm not there for him, you know, so that's all I want to talk about that.
Jessup says his problems have all been a result of his drug use, just like Jeff Elders, the guy who tried to steal $111 from JCPenney.
I've been locked up a few times. You know, rightfully so, I'm here. But I believe the court system should have an alternative for people, put me in long term. But, you know, that's just asking for the state to pay something else for me. You know, what can you do, you know, besides lock us up? But I feel I'm a decent person and deserve these chances, but I don't know. I don't believe that the state should be putting out thousands of dollars trying to rehabilitate me when I've shown that really I can't be rehabilitated. I'm 48 years old.
But of course, the state is spending thousands and thousands of dollars on Elders. In fact, Illinois spends more than $1 billion every year on corrections. And Elders says for him, it's not been terribly effective.
There's no rehabilitation. You know, this is supposed to be, what do you call it, a correctional facility? Does it help correct and send you back out to be a law-abiding citizen? Not so much. You know, when you're so overcrowded and they can't get to everybody. You know, there's not enough programs for everybody. You have to, can you get a job? No, there's not enough jobs. Can you go to school? There's not enough schooling. How are you fixing anything by throwing somebody in a bunk and saying, okay, your out-date's in 3 years, you know? Can't do nothing more for you.
On February 28th of this year, Elders was one of the approximately 1,700 inmates being held at Vandalia. 495 of those men, almost a third of the inmates, they were there on Class 4 felonies. Now, Class 4 is the lowest category, and many of those felonies, they're not really felony crimes. They're sort of misdemeanors, relatively minor crimes.
There's a significant cohort of people that we incarcerate each year who keep committing misdemeanor level crimes, but they do them over and over and over again.
Kathy Saltmarsh is the director of the Illinois Sentencing Policy Advisory Council. That group collects and analyzes data to study the consequences of sentencing decisions. Saltmarsh says you cannot be sentenced to prison for a misdemeanor, but if you commit a couple misdemeanors, then those convictions can be, and often are, rolled together to create a felony.
The system can get impatient with people that it sees over and over and over again, and, you know, there's a certain point at which it's like, okay, off to DOC you go.
Saltmarsh says when a judge sees the same offender repeatedly committing petty crimes, the judge has few options to increase the sentence other than the very costly prison option. But with 50,000 people jammed into prisons in Illinois, does it make sense to send someone like Jeff Elders there too? To spend $50,000 because he tried to steal $111 from JCPenney? Saltmarsh says the state of Illinois needs to start asking those questions. Saltmarsh says Illinois spends a lot of money locking up low-level offenders like elders.
You have a significant number of Class 4 felonies churning through DOC every year. They stay for a short time, and, you know, generally you see them coming back. The precious resources at the Department of Corrections that go to programming, generally a Class 4 offender isn't in DOC long enough to access any of that.
So low-level offenders get little in the way of rehabilitation, and they strain the already overcrowded department. Saltmarsh says the state of Illinois needs to make priorities for its limited criminal justice resources. A big part of that could be evaluating low-level offenses to figure out if prison is an effective and cost-effective way to deal with them. I'm Robert Wildeboer.
Join us again tomorrow at 12:40 on the Afternoon Magazine when Rob will have a follow-up story on healthcare in prisons. That's part three of WBEZ's series on prisons in Illinois. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine, and if you've been watching March Madness, perhaps you've been disappointed by the level of play this year or the officiating. I know a lot of Illini fans were pretty upset at that last week. But if you're Frank DeFord, well, you're upset by the fashions. Here's Frank.
There once was a wise old basketball coach named Arrid McCutchen who led the Evansville Purple Aces to 5 national championships in the small college division. And get this, dressing his Purple Aces in bright orange T-shirts. Now, I've been reminded of this recently as a number of grubby athletic directors have sold out to the sporting goods companies, allowing their teams to be costumed in the most hideous outfits. For openers, whoever decided that basketball uniforms should have a camouflage material? That makes about as much sense as attiring the Navy SEALs in tutus. Then we have the tacky day-glow ensembles, which have actually been modeled even by the likes of good old hidebound Notre Dame. But then it's been an ugly year all around for college basketball. The greatest irony of March Madness 2013 is that in a sport which highlights individual stars, there's simply none of any box office consequence playing in college. Well, not any men. The fabulous 6'8" Brittany Griner of Baylor may well become the greatest female player ever to adorn the sport. But never mind special men's players. There aren't any particularly good men's teams around either. The brackets lack it. Alas, the average team score is well down into the 60s, reminiscent more of the Paleolithic pre-jump shot era. Basketball, at its best, is an artful game of grace played with abandon by perhaps the finest, most complete athletes in the world. But the college sport has become too roughhouse. Officials permit defenders to deface the game's beauty, blocking, chucking, forearming, grabbing. And worse, it's those coaches who believe it's all about me. It used to be that football coaches were the scowling, conservative types. But college football is now a more appealing, wide-open game. Meanwhile, basketball coaches have clamped down, trading creativity for control. If Woody Hayes came back, he'd surely be a basketball coach, slowing down the tempo, while Johnny Wooden would be run-and-gunning the pistol formation on the gridiron. So what a special delight it was this past weekend to see this unknown 15th seed playing at top speed, laughing and loose, unchained by their unknown coach, who apparently hadn't heard that big-time coaches are supposed to button it down to prove their genius. The unknown team is Florida Gulf Coast. The unknown coach is Andy Infield. And hey, nice stylish uniforms, too. Oh, and speaking of uniforms, Arrid McCutchen didn't dress his Purple Aces in orange T-shirts just to please any Nike or Adidas. He did it because he concluded that orange was the easiest color to spot, say for one of his players throwing a fast break pass, and T-shirts were better for body warmth. Substance, not showing off.
That's Frank DeFord. He does commentaries on sports for NPR and is based in Connecticut.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 27th of March, 2013. It was on this day, 1851, a group of miners called the Mariposa Battalion entered the Yosemite Valley, hoping to drive out a tribe of Indians so they could do some mining there.
They thought they named the valley after the Indian tribe they were trying to drive out, but they got the name wrong. The tribe was called the Awanichi people. Yosemite was the name given them by other tribes as an insult. It meant those who kill. It was on this day, 1915, the woman known as Typhoid Mary was put into quarantine in a cottage in the Bronx. Mary Mallon, she was about 40, working as a cook in New York City, and every household she worked at came down with typhoid fever. Typhoid was common on battlefields. It may have killed more than 200,000 soldiers during the Civil War, but it was rarely seen in the wealthy households where she worked. In 1906, a doctor named George Soper noticed this strange pattern of outbreaks in wealthy homes, interviewed the families, found that they had all hired the same cook, and he finally tracked her down. Mary Mallon did not take it well when he asked her to provide a stool sample. She threatened him with a meat cleaver. He called the police, had her arrested. A stool sample was taken from her by force, and they discovered typhoid bacteria in her gallbladder. She admitted that she never washed her hands when she was cooking. They kept her in quarantine. She was released. She changed her name. She took up cooking again. She spread disease and death in her wake until they finally caught up with her again on Long Island, imprisoned her in the Bronx for the rest of her life, and she died of pneumonia in 1938. It's the birthday of John O'Farrell, born in Oxfordshire, England, 1962. For many years, he was a writer for The Spitting Image, a British satirical puppet TV show, author of a nonfiction book entitled An Utterly Exasperated History of Modern Britain or 60 Years of Making the Same Stupid Mistakes as Always. It's the birthday of the director and screenwriter Quentin Tarantino, born in Knoxville, 1963, raised in Los Angeles near the airport, high school dropout, worked in a big video store, watched movies all day, wrote screenplays. His first movie was Reservoir Dogs, 1992. 2 years later came his big hit, Pulp Fiction. And it's the birthday of Julia Alvarez, born New York City, 1950, grew up in the Dominican Republic, came back to New York when she was 10, author of books about being caught between two cultures. Her novel, How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents, came out in 1991. Also wrote a nonfiction book, Once Upon a Quinceañera, about the tradition of throwing elaborate 15th birthday parties for young Latina women. Here's a poem for today by Mae Sarton, Moose